This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 15th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me today Annie Anton. Annie Anton is an associate professor of software engineering at one of my favorite schools, North Carolina State University. Annie directs theprivacyplace.org and works on interesting and thorny issues surrounding privacy and security. Annie did all of her degrees in Atlanta at Georgia Tech, where she ultimately earned her PhD in 1997. In 1998, she was the first Latin American woman to join the College of Engineering faculty at NC State. Annie is also a first-generation American with strong beliefs about freedom and liberty. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Gary.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, the first question is a doozy, but it's really simple. What is privacy?
Well, privacy means a lot of things to a lot of different people. But I always view privacy as, I look at that first definition by Warren and Brandeis of basically the right to be let alone. And in today's context, I think it really means that you're able to control information about yourself and reveal things about yourself based on your own decisions rather than having other people reveal things about you.
I see. So do you think that Scott McNeely was right and we don't have any privacy after all and we should just get over it?
I think that to a certain extent he's right that in many contexts we don't have privacy. But I disagree with our having to get over it. I think that
we should have a temper tantrum.
Yes.
So what's the best? What's the most effective temper tantrum you can have?
I like to think that our group here at NC State is working hard to make a difference and find ways with technology and intersecting with law and with business management to find ways in which we can protect privacy.
Yeah, that's interesting. So as a casual web server, it seems to me that most large corporations pay lip service to privacy. They often post some sort of inscrutable privacy policy on their website mm-hmm. that nobody reads, except mm-hmm. for you guys. And so is corporate privacy mostly lip service these days? What have you done to look into that?
So it's interesting that you should mention that. So we did a review of the ChoicePoint privacy breach last year, and we made some recommendations regarding what companies should do to protect privacy and what to do about their, about giving notice when there is a breach and what kinds of things they should do, like regular audits, to make sure that they have a good data governance strategy and things that should be expressed in privacy policies and that it should really accurately describe a company's overall privacy principles and practices and accurately so that it really reflects what really takes place.
Do you think that's common or is that?
We don't think it's common. I think a lot of times a lawyer writes it with no communication with the people who've developed the systems that really handle the data.
Uh-huh.
But just about 2 weeks ago, one of my students and I spent a whole day at ChoicePoint meeting with the president, the CEO, the chief privacy officer, the chief legal officer, and they have really taken seriously
I bet.
The sanctions that were imposed on them.
Yeah.
And I think that they have really turned around from being, a glaring example of a company that people didn't know about and were very concerned about and probably weren't thinking about the ways in which they were collecting information and how it affects the public at large to now completely dramatically changing their business and their practices.
But they're still an anomaly, right? If they're doing the right thing. Because, privacy policies, to me, they remind me of awk scripts. I wrote one of those once, and then I copied it from there on out for about a decade and just made little changes here and there. And it seems like people sort of find a policy somewhere for privacy, and then they just mm-hmm. copy it and maybe make a couple of tweaks. Am I crazy?
Right. And that's not what we want to happen. I think ChoicePoint has really made sure that their policy truly conveys what they're doing. They have dropped some of the clients they had because the clients didn't want to go through extra effort to make sure that they were complying with certain policies that ChoicePoint now has.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and so I really think it's an example. It's unfortunate that it takes a breach and sanctions for companies to really start paying attention. It seems that ChoicePoint's really become a leader amongst the data brokers, and they're taking it very seriously, and they've cut out portions of their business and are doing a better job of like redacting information, even though they don't have to, from some of the public records that are deemed to not be necessary.
So corporate spankings actually work.
Right.
Question about other privacy policies. I know you did some work with the privacyplace.org organization to look
at... I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you, Gary.
Oh, to look at airline privacy policies. So what did you find out when you did that work?
So this was really interesting. We have been looking at... what we did was that we've called all of the American airlines, and we're now calling international airlines as well, looking to try to figure out what kinds of information they actually discuss in their privacy policies and seeing whether or not they can answer questions about ambiguities in their privacy policies.
Hmm.
And, you know, one thing that's really interesting and telling is whether a company has someone at the contact, with the contact information that they provide on their privacy policy, that if you have questions about their policy, you should call this number.
Mm-hmm.
And with the exception of one airline, the number that we call, they can't answer our questions.
Anything at all.
Right. And so the one that did was Alaska Airlines, where the gentleman who wrote the policy called us back.
Wow.
Within about 10 minutes and answered all our questions.
Wow.
Great satisfaction.
Wow.
And it's an interesting business model. He's a contractor. And he works for Alaska Airlines about 3 hours a week, and then he's on call the rest of the week.
Whenever somebody calls in.
Right. But at least they immediately knew who to contact, and it was great.
So maybe others should try to adopt that.
I think so. Yeah. Other airlines, when we called Air Canada, I don't have the exact raw data in front of me, but we called Air Canada, and the first person, we got a voicemail that said that she was on maternity leave until September. So if you had any questions, you should call.
When did you call her?
It was about 3 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And then her voicemail said that if you had any questions, to call this other person. So we called the other person. She was on maternity leave until March of next year.
What does this say about privacy officers?
It's a pregnant pause, apparently.
Oh, terrible. So...
Other airlines, I think one of the worst that we encountered was United Airlines, where we had to make three total calls, and we were transferred three times. And we ended up on the phone for 25 minutes with someone in India.
Uh-huh.
And when we asked questions, she said that she wasn't the right person to answer any of the questions, and so we asked to speak with the supervisor.
Uh-huh.
So she put us on hold for 2 minutes and came back and said, "We don't share with government agencies or offices because you have a Social Security number." That's a quote-unquote. And then we asked her for a corporate office or legal department phone number. She got very agitated and yelled at us.
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, it's
didn't you have
really
one who said, "Well, you should read the privacy policy"?
Oh,
well, that's what we're calling about.
So we sent email, we filled out web forms, and we called. And then with the emails, when we sent email to Continental, it took them 7 days to get back to us. And it was their privacy compliance contact that got back to us in 7 days. And she said, "Please review the privacy policy."
Right.
The first sentence in our email said, "We've just read the privacy policy and we have a question."
We have some questions.
Right. And then JetBlue Airways took 9 days to answer and also said, "Please review the privacy policy. And if you have questions, we're happy to respond. But it's more efficient if you read it first."
Are there other groups that are doing work like this, or are you guys the only one?
I think we're the only ones. We actually started this study actually, it's not true. I just found out that there is a group in Canada that has called, they had like a large group of people that were either calling companies or examining companies' privacy policies.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know much about that. I just became aware of it this week. It's something similar to what we were doing.
But it's still
pretty
rare.
But it's very rare, yes. And those were just for Canadian companies.
Right. So regulations have played a role in at least improving the awareness of privacy, I think, especially when it comes to data. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of things like HIPAA and Gramm-Leach-Bliley.
Right.
But it also seems that corporate standards such as PCI, the credit card standard, can move the ball up the field. What do you think is the best way to impose progress on reticent corporations? Is it regulation or is it corporate standards? You know, what do you think?
I think that regulation is a step in the right direction, but one of the problems we're having is that regulations aren't being properly enforced.
Mm-hmm.
And so with HIPAA, for example, most of the enforcement is complaint-driven. And until there's a complaint, nothing is really enforced, and therefore...
I bet you most of the complaints are about those stupid forms you got to fill out every time you go to the doctor.
Possibly. but, you know, there have been breaches, and I think people follow complaints, and then, you know, FTC investigates, but there's no real mechanism right now for enforcing this, and part of it is that we don't have the technology to help companies kind of self-monitor, if you
will,
for that compliance, and that's something that we've been working on our group here at NC State.
So that's kind of a weakness in government regulation, but PCI, on the other hand, seems to have made a lot of people jump on the, at least let's protect credit card data information.
Right.
So do you think that might be more effective, or too early to tell?
I think the jury's still out.
Uh-huh. Pretty interesting. We've seen PCI really move software security forward.
Right.
But so did Sarbanes-Oxley, and
right.
It's hard to tell which one is more effective.
Mm-hmm.
So when I recently visited NC State and I gave a talk about exploiting online games, I talked about the state of flux in the legal situation. So, say, comparing EULAs and case law in online game world. And I also talked about the kinds of spyware-based security that is being used by some game companies. Do you think that consumers know about this stuff?
I don't think that consumers know about it, and I think that one of the challenges we have is figuring out the kinds of EULAs that people understand and comprehend,
mm-hmm.
and really making sure that they read the EULAs that pertain to the things that they most care about.
Mm-hmm. Especially when it comes to privacy, I assume.
Right. And we have a student, one of my master's thesis students, did for his thesis a experiment where he presented privacy policies in four different representations,
mm-hmm.
and had people then he looked at what their perceptions were about those policies as well as what their comprehension was of those policies.
Right.
And what we found is that the perception and the comprehension are really misaligned.
Mm-hmm.
And so they perceive that natural language policies are more descriptive and
uh-huh.
thorough, and yet they understand them the worst.
That's interesting.
They comprehend them the worst. We found that when you prevent categories such as, for instance, the FIPS, you know, a certain category of things that are specified like notice and awareness or
yeah.
security, that they comprehend the policies a lot better because you're just providing the abstraction.
Huh. So what I've found is that in the online games thing, at least, these EULAs are pretty clear. It's not unclear. It says, we are going to install some software on your machine, and we're going to monitor it. People
right.
just don't read it, or they just
is,
click accept, or, you know, whatever.
I think that, so I haven't seen any of these, because I don't usually do these kinds of games.
Uh-huh.
But
do you actually read EULAs of all the software you run?
I read a lot of EULAs. I don't install a lot of software, so I don't normally read that kind of EULA. But I think one of the challenges is if you present entirely too much information in a EULA,
yeah.
that they don't read it.
Right, because you just scroll past the first 900 pages and just click
right.
accept.
But if we find out what it is that people really care about or what are their concerns, and we present those, maybe they'll read them.
Well, maybe there should be like a Surgeon General's warning that says, you know,
sure.
this says that if you run this software, it'll put spyware on your machine.
Right.
And to some extent, California law is like that because they have a distinct law about spyware and what companies are not allowed to do. So,
right.
so some companies will put stuff into their EULA and presumably into their privacy policy that is not legal and can't be really enforced. Which is an interesting thing, too. I think we got a long way to go with case law to catch up.
We do. Especially if you think about HIPAA, we really don't have case law. It's just going to start developing now. You know, talking about the EULAs also reminds me, we did a survey back in 2002 of over 1,000 Internet users where we were trying to figure out what it is that consumers really are most concerned about and whether that maps to what is actually expressed in privacy policies online. And we found a complete misalignment. So consumers were most concerned with an order. They were concerned with information transfer, notice and awareness, and information storage.
Right.
And in contrast, what the policies emphasize is data integrity and security, information collection, and user choice and consent.
Right, so it's pretty different.
Right. So the things that people want to see in the policies are not being emphasized.
Yeah. So one of the things that's happening right now as we speak is that Google's attempting to buy DoubleClick. And consummation of that deal would produce a huge aggregation of personal data, the likes of which have never been seen on the planet before. You got any thoughts about that?
Be afraid.
Is it sort of an unavoidable privacy trend, though, this aggregation?
I don't see it stopping anytime soon.
Yeah, I remember there was some company in the dot-com days, one of the first ones to go bust. Maybe it was one of those pet food stores. And they'd collected a lot of information about their consumers, which they said in their privacy policy they were going to do this and that and this and that with the data. But when it came down to the fire sale, they actually sold all the data to make some money for the creditors that they owed millions of dollars to.
It reminds me of the Toy Smart case where Toy Smart and their privacy policy said they wouldn't collect, you know, or sell any information or
maybe
share
it was
any information. And what they got caught for was that when they went belly up in their bankruptcy proceedings, it said they would sell their database. And their database contained the names and ages of people's children.
Right.
It was a violation of COPPA.
Right. That's really interesting.
Right. And their parent company decided to buy that and destroy the data. And
that's probably a good
solution.
And
that parent company was Disney.
Oh, was it? Fancy that.
Yes.
So these aggregations of data, I guess, it's hard to keep data from aggregating, and there are more and more opportunities for that to happen.
Right, and I think one of the big concerns that people have is that we provide our data for a certain purpose, and we expect it to be used for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the concern, the big privacy concern, is that downstream, that data gets used for other purposes.
Well, that's
that
because,
we did not agree to.
You know, outside of the United States, you own your own personal data, but in the United States, whoever collects it owns the data,
right,
which is an odd thing. Do you think there's any conception of that among lawmakers, or is that just like privacy arcana that nobody even knows?
I'd like to think, but I don't know. I really don't know.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to change something like that when so much information is out there.
Yeah.
I think recently I heard someone say, well, we really shouldn't be concerned about this because, you know, it's all out there anyway. And I thought, you know, there are future generations for which that information has not yet been developed, and I think we should consider fixing it so that they don't have to deal with this problem.
McNeely might be right now, but not in the future.
Exactly.
Not for my kids.
Right.
So, you know, speaking of the government, the Patriot Act, in my view, is an affront to privacy and a sort of a poor trade-off for so-called security. And so the question is, what tools do lawmakers have to negotiate really tricky trade-offs like that between personal liberty and privacy and security? And are there any tools they have at their disposal?
I'm not aware. That's a really good question. I really don't know.
See, because part of the problem is that us geeks like to whine a lot about this stuff, but then we're not educating the people that are making the laws that we then complain about.
So I know that the Department of Homeland Security is really trying to develop tools that will enable them to do the kind of, you know, identification of, like, for instance, folks that should not be coming in the country.
Mm-hmm. And like guys with tuberculosis, for example.
Exactly. yeah, and, you know, security is as good as your weakest link. So if you have someone who says, he looks okay, you know, then they can get in.
Even though the computer's flashing red.
Exactly. You know, and certainly that's not a technology issue. That's, you know, a human issue. But frankly, most security problems are because of humans, whether they develop the software that has the vulnerability in it or whether the folks that use it and have to make decisions based on what information is in the system. But I think that there are attempts to be able to to achieve these tasks of identifying people while trying to maintain the information as private as possible.
Yeah, I know there was some, you know, the one thing that Poindexter did that got completely panned, and then Congress reached down and scratched the item out of DARPA's budget, the Total Information Awareness Program.
Right.
There was actually a privacy-based set of research that was going on that was talking about data mining and trying to keep things private while you still mine this huge data.
Right.
Ironically, really probably good research,
but
it fell under the really scary government gets in your underwear drawer type stuff.
Right.
Yeah, so these are tough things. I think we need to do more to get the government to have a better clue about security and security trade-offs. So a completely different topic. What kind of advice would you give to women that are interested in pursuing a career in computer science and engineering?
That's a very interesting question. I think I've always been really attracted to problems in computer science that have to do with humans or with things that have an impact on society. And so my background, as you know, is in requirements engineering. Mm-hmm. And so within the field of software engineering, that's the kind of subspecialty where you're interacting with the end users and the customers and the clients and trying to satisfy all of their different and sometimes competing needs and make sure that you develop a software package that satisfies all of them so that they will enjoy using it and really not have any concerns about, well, you didn't develop software I wanted, so I'm not going to use it. So that's always appealed to me, being able to do something where I'm communicating with end users and clients, and then being also able to kind of translate that to something that architects can and software engineers can actually run with and implement.
So making computer science more human.
Right.
Yeah.
And also going from the informal to the formal.
You so know, you think informal. That'll appeal more to women than say?
It appealed to me. I don't know if it appeals to all women. And the other thing more recently is this issue of policy and legal compliance is very interesting to me, especially in the healthcare domain, because people are very concerned and consider information about their medical diagnoses to be very sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that we can do to help, you know, maintain confidentiality of patient records is something that's very appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most women like working in areas where, we really do see the impact of our work.
Right.
And that it's really helping people.
Okay, last question. What non-geek book are you currently reading?
What non-geek book am I currently reading?
A non-geek book.
I can't remember the name of it. I just started reading it last week. It's called, you're going to laugh, but it's called, I think, Letters to a Young Catholic that my high school religion teacher sent me.
Ah, because you just did the commencement.
Right,
address.
So I gave commencement address at my high school. And nice. And so Monsignor Lopez sent me two books, and I'm reading one of them. And I think it's called Letters to a Young Catholic, but I can look that up and let you know later what it really is. It's at home.
That makes you sound good.
Yeah. The first chapter was
on. You can send us that
on,
and then send us what you're really reading.
Well, he sent me two, and I picked this one to read first because the first chapter said, from Baltimore to Milledgeville, and I was born in Milledgeville, so that was appealing to me. It talked about Flannery O'Connor, the author Flannery O'Connor in Milledgeville.
Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.